Join me in Nehemiah chapter 6, if you will. Nehemiah chapter 6. A few of us spent the spring working through this Old Testament book. Had the privilege of teaching through the book a few times. It's one of my favorites. I love the story. Of course, every time you go through a book, you kind of see and appreciate new things. And so I wanted to share with you this morning something that really impressed me as we worked in the book during the spring. As the picture on the slide would give away, when we think of this book, if we are familiar with it, typically the first thing that comes to mind is the rebuilding of the wall of Jerusalem. That's what's going on in the book. It was written just after the Babylonian captivity, and the people have made their way back to the land. They're trying to resettle the land and rebuild their lives there. And that's just not moving along very quickly. And years and years and years go by, and still the city has no wall, which doesn't sound that much that significant, I think, to me and you. I assure you it wasn't just a landscaping issue, okay? The wall was their primary defense against an enemy. I mean, without a wall, the enemy just could march right into the middle of your city. And so it wasn't just that the defense was lost. I mean, you were hardly a city if you didn't even have that fundamental piece. It was kind of embarrassing, to be honest. And so Nehemiah, who's working in the court of the Persian king, learns about this. He's very disturbed, and he's determined to go back, help the people get the wall rebuilt. And so much of the story in the early part of the book is all about how he does that. And he's quite successful, which is why I invited you to chapter 6. Because in verse 15, we're told, so the wall was completed on the 25th of the month of Elul in 52 days. Look at that. It is amazing how quickly, under the leadership of this great Old Testament character, they got this job done fast. It's a great story. But if you know the book, you know that chapter 6, that marks the finishing of the wall, chapter 6 is only, well, it's not even quite halfway through the book. So if the book's about rebuilding the wall, and by chapter 6, that's done, what else is there to talk about? I would contend this morning that what is left is the more important story in Nehemiah, and one that I fear does not get as much attention because we too are consumed with the cool construction project. Because you see, not only does the book describe the renewal of this city? Jerusalem is coming back. But it also describes the spiritual renewal of the people. Two events that are not unrelated to each other. If you look back to chapter 6, the very next verse, verse 16, goes on to say, when our enemies heard of it, that is the completion of the wall, and all the nations surrounding us saw it, they lost their confidence because they recognized, watch this, that this work had been accomplished with the help of our God. Everybody, even the neighbors, knew they only pulled this off because God was helping them pull this off. It was clear that it's his involvement in their effort that made them successful. And so I think it is that fact that moves the people to renew their relationship with him, which is what I think the rest of the book is about. And this morning I'd like to invite you to think with me a little bit about that. Go ahead and go to chapter 8. That's essentially where we'll spend our time this morning. But I do want to challenge you, not just to see those people and what happened to them at this important moment in their history. I want to challenge you to find yourself in this story. Because I think almost all of us have periods of our life where, like these people, we need spiritual renewal too. In fact, I just wonder, it's a large crowd. Surely there's someone sitting here today that describes you. Maybe you've been discouraged, or you've been losing a struggle with a weakness, or you've lost your sense of passion, and you're here and you've kept coming, but you're just going through the motions because you know it's what you're supposed to do, but the passion is gone, and you need revival. You need spiritual renewal. Maybe you are literally in that place this morning. I want to warn you, brothers and sisters, that is a dangerous season. It's almost like we're at a split in the road, and there are two ways to go. And so if I can find myself here, maybe I can also learn some things about those seasons from people who were there and who did the right thing. So will you join me in thinking about that this morning? I want to begin in chapter 8, because to me, chapter 8 is where the story really shifts to this change in the people, and that shift is centered around an event that takes place where the people are gathered at the Watergate. I know everyone over 60, like I am, is thinking of a hotel in Washington, D.C., right? I mean, that's just where our brains go. So to be clear, there's no political scandal involved in this place. This isn't a hotel in D.C., and it doesn't involve Richard Nixon. This is literally a place in Jerusalem. In fact, Scott Powell and I spent about 20 minutes in my office this week figuring out exactly where the spot was, okay? But it's a spot in Jerusalem where the people are coming together. I suspect this event is connected with the Feast of Trumpets, which was one of their annual feasts that's happening right about this same time. And let's pick up in chapter 8 in verse 1. The text says, "All the people gathered as one man at the square which is in front of the water gate. And they asked Ezra the scribe to bring the book of the law of Moses, which the Lord had given to Israel." Now, I'm going to ask you to notice three phrases with me. The first one is here in verse 1. The first phrase is this: they asked. Now, the reason I point that out, I know it seems unremarkable, but the reason I point it out is that up to this point in the book, the story had not been about the people. The story had been about Nehemiah. Nehemiah initiated everything. I mean, he came on his own initiative, and he was the one rallying the people to get going on this project. And when adversity came up, Nehemiah led the way to push the opponents back, those who were trying to oppose their work. It was all about Nehemiah. Until you get to chapter 8 and verse 1. And it's not Nehemiah. They asked. Who's they? The people who had come together that first day of the month before the Watergate. The people are saying, "We want you to bring God's book, and we want you to read it to us." Now, look at verses 2 and 3. Let's keep going. It says, "Then Ezra the priest brought the law before the assembly of men, women, and all who could listen with understanding on the first day of the seventh month. He read it before the square, which is in front of the water gate, from early morning until midday in the presence of men and women and those who could understand." Watch this. "And all the people were attentive to the book of the law." That last phrase is what I wanted you to think about. That's our second phrase. All the people were attentive. What do you think that means? What does that stir up in your mind? I could be really tacky this morning and say, "Are you attentive right now? Are you?" Because we know there are different ways to listen to sermons, right? We could sit there and we could look and we could listen, and be wondering, will the Astros sweep the Dodgers today? Right? That's where our brain might be. Or is it Mexican or barbecue? Where are we going for lunch when we get done? And oh good, David is preaching. That means we can get there before the crowd, right? I'm sorry, but y'all know it's true, right? You could be listening and you could be somewhere else, right? And that's not what these people are doing. The text says they are attentive. They are plugged in. They are listening to the words. Here's what I'm trying to say. This wasn't a ritual exercise that they're going through. They want this. Then drop down to verse number 7. Because we have this whole list of Levites whose job it is to explain the law to the people, right? And then verse 8 adds, they read from the book, from the law of God, translating to give the sense, watch this, here's our phrase, so that they understood the reading. That's the last phrase I wanted you to notice. They understood the reading. And if you read that whole segment there from 1 to 8, that point is emphasized over and over and over again. It was important not that you just get up and do this ritual exercise. The people need to listen and they need to understand what is being read. Why was that so important? They're hearing God, folks. This is what God had said to them. And so this is how they heard him and listened to him, by letting his book be read so that they would know what his will is. Now, here's the interesting thing. If we would just keep marching through the back half of this book, this is a pattern with them. In just a little bit later, in chapter 8 and verse 13, some leaders gather the next day, and guess what they're doing? They're studying the law again. And then you get to the end of the chapter, and they're observing the Feast of Tabernacles, and guess what they're doing? They're reading the law every day. And then in chapter 9 and verse 3, they gather for a day of mourning, and a fourth of the day, one fourth of that entire day is devoted to the reading of the law. In chapter 13 and verse 1, when they are dedicating the wall that's been built, the book of the law of Moses again was read aloud in their hearing. Here's the point I'm trying to get you to see. As these people realized they needed to renew their relationship with God, that started with his book and reading it and understanding it. And that book becomes their compass. Everything else they do is led and directed by the things that are in the book. And so let me put this word on the slide for you. This reading was critical to everything that was going on. I want to pause because I think there's a lesson here for us as we wrestle with our own seasons when we need spiritual renewal. Sometimes I think we struggle to figure out what it is that we ought to do because we lean too much on our feelings and not enough on what God said. Okay, did y'all catch that? Because that was important this morning. We lean too much on how we're feeling and not enough on what God said in his book. I have found this to be true, for example, with some folks I've talked to who were struggling to figure out what kind of religion they were going to be involved in. I've talked to a lot of young people over the years, some of them who, after they grow up and got away from home, were making their own choice about where they were going to worship and what kind of church and what kind of worship. And so sometimes they would go off and find themselves at a place where the worship was livelier, different than this, right? Sometimes what they would say about that is the worship there is more spiritual, and that probably needs some unpacking too. I'm not sure we're using that idea in the right way. But the other problem is that they're finding that in a church whose teaching does not line up with what God said in his book. And even these worship practices that they found so much more lively and exciting don't line up in the thing with the things that are in God's book. And when you bring that up and try to talk about it, here's the pushback. I know, but I feel like this is where I need to be. Sometimes they even attribute the feeling of God. I just feel like the Spirit of God in me is moving me to go to this place. I want to tell you, brothers and sisters, we get in this business of leaning on feelings rather than what's on in the book, we're going to get ourselves into trouble. You see the problem? I've had some people say that about their marriage. Couples get in a bad place. Someone's ready to walk away. And you start trying to say, yes, but the book says, and people will push back and say, yes, but I just feel like God would not want me in this lousy situation. I just feel like the Spirit is leading me away from this marriage to start over with something new. So can I talk straight to you this morning? Can we be plain with each other? Because we should never allow feelings to override what God said in the book. You with me on that? We should never let feelings override what God said in the book. Let me be plain. God is not going to lead me to a church that isn't teaching the truth about salvation, folks, or whose worship is unsound and does not honor him. And if I have the feeling that that's where I'm supposed to be, maybe those are my feelings, and I want them to be from God. Let me say it again. It's dangerous territory where I start depending on how I feel and letting that override what's in the book. Folks, if I want to set things right with God, and I'm trying to decide what kind of church I ought to go to, where I ought to worship, I need to be in the book. I need to be letting him speak and him guide. The word needs to be my compass in that. Y'all buy that? Are we together on that? Just like Israel. I would add, God is not going to lead me to make a choice about my marriage that conflicts with his will for marriage, which he said in the book. And if I have a feeling that God is leading me out of my marriage, that God's leading me to get a divorce, and that's against what he said in the book, that may be my feeling and not something that's coming from him. You know what I need when I'm struggling in my marriage? The book. I need to be reading what he says and letting that be my compass and letting that guide me. As this crowd in Jerusalem sought to reconnect with God, the book was the compass. It guided everything they did. And why not? It's God speaking. And so for me and you, the same is true, especially in seasons where we're discouraged or we're drifting. More than ever, those are the seasons where I need to open his book and do exactly what they did. I need to read, figure out what his will is. Now, as we continue through chapter 8, there's a second thing that I want you to notice to me. I'll put this word on the slide right up front. The second thing that I want you to notice is the response of the people to the reading. So that's what we start with. They read, but then as we get deeper into the story, they begin to respond to the reading. So this is chapter 8 and verse number 9. Then Nehemiah, who was the governor, and Ezra, the priest and scribe, and the Levites who taught the people, said to all the people, "This day is holy to the Lord your God. Do not mourn or weep, for all the people were weeping when they heard the words of the law." How do they respond? With profound grief. The kind of grief that provokes weeping and sobbing. In fact, the best I could figure out here is that this was supposed to be a day of celebration, because as the law is read, everybody starts crying. And then Nehemiah and Ezra and other leaders start running around saying, no, not today, not today. Today is supposed to be a celebration day. And they're going to have a weeping day. It's in chapter 9 later in the book. My question for you is, why did they respond this way? And we know, don't we? When you get in the book, sometimes what it does is it shines that painful light on my spiritual failure and my sin. And I think that's what's happening here. They're seeing their sin as the book is read. And it's worse than that. Their sin that they're seeing now is lying there right against God's goodness that they had just witnessed. It's literally a structure surrounding them. They could see God's goodness with the wall, and they realize we have not been good to him. And so much of the back half of the book is devoted to dealing with their sin. They talk about specific sins in the back half of this book. Interestingly, sins, it seems to me, that contributed to the spiritual decline and drift of the nation. For example, they were not taking care of the priests and the Levites. They were supposed to regularly make contributions so they would be supported and they could do their work for the people, which included teaching the law. But that's not going on. And so the priests and the Levites are having to go out and work the field so they can feed their families, which means not as much time to teach the people. And so there is a drought in Jerusalem, a drought of teaching. They're not getting the word of God, but it's worse than that. Because in addition to not supporting the priests and Levites so they can do their job, they're also interacting, even intermarrying with their idolatrous neighbors. And they're bringing that influence into their life. So think about the bad timing of that. As you're hearing less and less from God, you're hearing more and more from the corrupt people around you. And now you begin to understand how all this is happening. And so there's a lot said about their repentance in these closing chapters of the book, how they acknowledge their sin, as how they're grieving over it, which we see here. There's more about that. What's really fascinating to me is these people are committed to dealing with it like they draw up a document and sign it that expresses their commitment to God that we're going to do what you want us to do. So let me pause and ask you to think about how this speaks to me and you. And really how this connects back to what we were saying about the word. Sometimes the reason I'm struggling spiritually, the reason I'm discouraged or I'm weak or I'm drifting is because I'm not doing the things that I need to do to be spiritually healthy. You see that? If I just kind of show up and go through the motions, I don't spend any time in the Word, our prayer life is dead, I'm with the world and not with other disciples, what does that do to us spiritually? Sometimes I'm not doing the things that I need to do to be spiritually healthy. Or sometimes I am doing things I shouldn't do, things that make me weak. And it's at times like this that I need to get in the book. Because what's the book going to do? It's going to smack me around a little bit, right? As Jeff likes to say, start reading the book, God starts messing with your life, right? And it starts shining that painful light and saying, well, here you go. Here's what's going on, David. Here's why you're weak. Here's why you're drifting. I can see where I really am with God. So I can see what's holding me back. So I can see what needs to change. Sometimes experiences with God's words are painful. Grief inspiring. Please know that I know there's a need for balance in our teaching. It shouldn't be that every time we sit in a Bible class or listen to a sermon, we feel like we're getting beat up. But can I be crystal clear about something? If you never feel that way, you're not getting the teaching you need. And if I'm never hearing that when I'm spending my time in the Word, I'm not reading it right. Folks, listen. God is not telling us, I want to accept you just the way you are. Whatever relationship you're in, however you're choosing to live your life, I'm cool with that. I just want us to have a thing with each other, and I'm going to accept you the way you are. If you believe that, you're not reading the book. Because that's not what he says at all. In fact, the opposite. In Ephesians 4, what Paul says is, I want to make you into a whole new person. I want to wipe the slate clean, and I want to form you in the image of my son, and you'll spend the rest of your life tweaking and changing and growing and maturing, becoming more and more like him. It's a never-ending process of that. And I'm going to tell you something, folks. That is not the message of culture. If you want a feel-good church, it's there. And someone's making people feel good this morning. But not making people like Jesus, which is our calling. So, a couple of questions. When I dig into the Word, first, do I? And when I do, do I let it challenge me? Do I let it serve as a mirror for me to look at my life? And when I do that and I'm challenged, how do I respond? Can we get real specific about that? Are you still able to read your Bible and feel guilty? To read a passage and say, now God's talking to me. I have failed there. I need to do better. Do you ever shed tears? Do we still have the capacity to be heartbroken when we've let down this God that's been so good to us? And all around us is the evidence. What is our response? As we dig into the Word and let God speak. One more thing I want you to notice. Back to chapter 8. Let's close out the chapter. There's another meeting. I mentioned this earlier. Verse 13. Then on the second day, the heads of the father's households and all the people, the priests and the Levites were gathered together to Ezra the scribe, that they might gain insight into the words of the law. So the second day, there's another gathering, a smaller one this time, a leadership gathering. And what are they doing? They're back in the Word. They're studying more. And it's while they're doing this that a discovery is made. Look down at 14 now. They found written in the law how God had commanded through Moses that the sons of Israel should live in booths during the feast of the seventh month. The Feast of Tabernacles was upon them, at this point literally just days away. And so my guess is, they know that, and because they know that, that's the reading that they select when this leadership group gathers. The Feast of Tabernacles is coming. We ought to look at what God says about that. And here's the thing. As they're looking at what God says, they make this discovery that they've neglected something all this time. That in the law, God had said, during the Feast of Tabernacles, you are to build booths and live in them. Like little shelters made of branches and palm leaves and that kind of stuff. I think the idea is to remind them of when their forefathers were in the wilderness and had to live in temporary shelters and how God had provided and cared for them during that journey. And it was a reminder that he's a God who would care for you too. They were supposed to live in these shelters. But for some reason, that part of the observance had been forgotten for a long, long time. They weren't doing that. Still observing the feast, just not the camping piece of it. Well, how would you respond to that? I suppose it would have been really easy to say, well, I mean, That's just a detail. And we've been doing this the other way for a long, long time. And you can remember all of that without camping, to which I would have given a hearty amen. Because if there was any part of the Feast of Tabernacles that I would not want to keep, it would be the camping part, right? Because camping is terrible. I know, you're going to argue with me when this is over, but it still is. It is the height of human arrogance, and we wrestle with it all the time, to take what God said in His instructions and decide which parts are important and which aren't. So how would they respond? Verse 15. So they proclaimed and circulated a proclamation in all their cities and in Jerusalem, saying, go to the hills and bring olive branches and wild olive branches, myrtle branches, palm branches, and branches of other leafy trees to make booths. Are you watching? What's that last phrase? You see it? As it is written. So the people went out and brought them and made booths for themselves, each on his own roof and in their courts and in the courts of the house of God, in the square at the water gate and in the square at the gate of Ephraim. The entire assembly of those who had returned from captivity made booths and lived in them. The sons of Israel had indeed not done so from the days of Joshua the son of Nun to that day. So what did they do? They made booths. They spread the word about this to everybody. I mean, I wonder if any of the trees after this had branches at all. They're just cutting them all down and building their shelters. Do you see the end of verse 17? And there was great rejoicing. I wonder why that is. Why do you think they rejoiced? Was it that this new piece that they brought back just kind of added to the excitement? Maybe, except for non-camping people like me. But the interesting thing is, all the way down through this segment, there is this emphasis on keeping the law of God. If you look at verse 14, as they're wrestling with this booth thing they've discovered, they talk about the fact that this is written in the law. And again, the Lord commanded this. And again, in verse 15, they did this because it was written. And then referring to a solemn assembly in verse 18, at the end of the feast, this was according to the ordinance. What are they doing? Exactly what God told them to do. And it's when they did exactly what God told them to do that the text says there was great rejoicing. There's our third word. I wonder if when I say that, there are people who hear box-checking religion. Is that what you hear? Oops! Feast of Tabernacles. We're checking all the boxes, but we found an extra one. There's a booth building box, and we haven't been doing that. Let's check that off. Box checking religion. I don't think this is what's going on at all. I think these people are living out their relationship with God. They could look around them and see the wall that God had built. A symbol of how good He had been to them. And what they wanted to do, they wanted to be good to Him. They wanted to show their love to Him. And how did they do that? They listened to what He said. And when they realized there were ways that they were not doing what he said, they grieved over that, repented. And they started doing what he said. And when they did that, it gave them great joy. They're living out their relationship with God. So I just can't help but wondering if there's somebody today in this crowd that needs to do that. Maybe you've been discouraged. Maybe you're wrestling and losing a battle with a weakness. Maybe you find yourself, maybe you've been drifting. Maybe you're spiritually indifferent and just feel like you're going through the motions, but you're not really engaged, attentive to your covenant with God. And you know, it isn't where I ought to be spiritually. You feel it. What you need is renewal. How do you do that? Exactly like they did. You hear him. You identify what the trouble spots are. And because you love him and you want that relationship with him, you address them and rejoice. It would be so cool to rejoice with you today. If you're a wayward disciple who needs to come home, hear his voice, make that right, we'd love to celebrate that with you today. Maybe you've never made the choice to follow Jesus and you need to confess your faith in him and be baptized for the remission of sins. You need to hear him and do what he says. We can rejoice with you today, and heaven will too. If you need to respond, make your way to the front right now while we stand, while we sing.